Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. Dow held up best during the week. He takes a look at crude, gold, and the Canadian and U.S. dollars. Publisher of thetrendletter.com, Martin Strath comments on the trends for the Dow, precious metals, oil, and whether cryptocurrencies can survive their big crash. Publisher of WolfStreet.com, Wolf Richter checks in from San Francisco to talk about the auto market, including used vehicles, Tesla, and repossessions. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Introducing Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. Find him on Twitter at ChartsByRoss. Welcome back to This Week in Money, and Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, Hanukkah, and Kwanzaa, and anything else you want to throw in.
I think you grabbed them all there, Jim, and yes, the best to you, your family, and all the listeners.
So, has Santa been kind to the markets this week?
No, you know, Santa Claus rally sort of petered out here about 5 or 6 days ago. We had that big reversal a week ago, and markets, depending upon where you are, the industrials, the Dow stocks, have held up exceptionally well. Just gave back maybe about 25% of the gain off the October lows, and you know that's October, November. That's where you want to see your seasonal low. You're going to rally in through December. You usually get an oversold somewhere between the 10th of December and Christmas, and then get a bit of a pop towards the end of the year. But overall, the choppiness usually in that last 2 weeks of December, and we've definitely seen that right now. So as I say, the Dow has been holding up the best. If you look at the S&P, it probably gave back about half of the gain off the bottom. And if you go over to the NASDAQ and look at the Qs, that's turning into like a triple bottom. It's right back down within a hair of what it did in October. So the, when you're taking a look at the rotation, typically, because there's a bull market always somewhere. Industrials definitely are high on the list at this point. And, you know, if we take a look at the energies, most of those, especially the Canadian ones, have held up exceptionally well during the last couple of months here. So you had that big high in the summer. Hard correction, but most of those are starting to stair-step back up. And, you know, I got a list here of about a dozen Canadian oil stocks, and you just look at them, and they are just nice, methodical uptrends and good oversold readings that in the last week and a half, enough to give it a bit of a springboard to the upside.
What's going on with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
Things have quietened right down over there. The dollar index, 104.30. We've been at this, sort of in this range, from 106 down to 103 with just a small downside bias here on the dollar index. It's got enough, maybe enough, on the downside that, any upside reversal at this point could have some legs. I still think that the 108 range is something that we might see in the near future. If we look at the Canadian dollar, very quiet in here, especially the last 2 weeks, plus or minus, a half a cent from 73.5. So just biding its time, has not rallied back with the oil market very well in this last 2 weeks. So overall, still thinking that the bias on the Canadian is to the downside. So I think as long as it stays below the 74 cent level, I'd think of it as an item that it should be still sold.
Gold and silver?
Gold and silver. So weekly signals on gold market and the silver market over about a week and a half ago. And they are just biding their time, but I'm hoping that we get a small correction in here in the miners and the bullion. Typically, if you look at the last 10 years or so, there's been what do we get, 80% of the years from here through March, you've seen a rally in gold. 87% of those years, you've seen a rally in silver. The numbers can be small, maybe in the 6 to 10% range for silver, but that's enough that the miners could get a decent lift here. So I would be because we've had this nice run off the bottom, and that was that triple bottom in gold, and managed to pick that one off nicely. Just hoping that we get enough of a sell off here to. Step back in, just say with the overbought readings we got, took some money off the table. We'll look for a new entry opportunity.
Ross, thank you so much for the update, and I hope Santa is very generous.
Let's hope he is, and some of this white stuff that's on the ground here dissipates. The best to you.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on Twitter at chartsbyross. Coming up, Martin Strath, next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Martin Strath, founder of Trend News, online at thetrendletter.com. He's speaking to us from Coquitlam, British Columbia, which is just east of Vancouver. Martin, welcome back to This Week in Money, and happy holidays.
Happy holiday to you too, Jim. Good to be back.
Can you tell us a bit about Trend News, the letters you publish, and how people can sign up?
Oh, sure. We have three services. The first one is the Trend Letter. I started publishing that back in 2002, so we're heading into our 21st year. It's a weekly publication. It's about 50 pages. It covers the equities, currencies, precious metals, commodities, and bonds. So those 50 pages, it's mostly charts with key bullet points to make it really easy to understand. So, a 10-15 minute read. The audience for that would be longer-term investors who want to get a better understanding of what drives these markets. The second one is their Trend Technical Trader. That's an online service that we started as a hedging service, but it has expanded now, and we've got it covers commodities, equities, precious metals, etc. The focus group there would be more active investors. But again, it's still a hedging service, so any investor would benefit from it, especially during these bear market times that we're in. And the third one is the Trend Disruptors. That's a monthly publication, and that's in the disruptive technology. So we're looking at artificial intelligence, virtual reality, augmented reality, 5G, cloud, Internet of Things, all that cool stuff. Now, obviously, that's a very speculative sector. And we have not added any new recommendations during this bear market. But we do have a really nice watch list that we've built up, which is now sitting at over 30 companies. The audience here would be for those wishing to speculate, but only with risk capital that they could afford to lose. Anybody that's interested in any of those or all of those can go to thetrendletter.com. That's all one word, thetrendletter.com. And or email us at info@thetrendletter.com.
Does the Dow look like it's undergoing a pullback in a continuing bull market or resuming a bear market?
Well, the Dow's been, the strongest of all the indices so far. I mean, it had a really nice rally from that October low, I think, 20% or so. But that rally was really fueled by all the excitement, I guess, on the inflation data being weaker. And so the market then assumed that inflation had peaked, then the Fed would then probably pause their rate hikes, maybe even pivot, which would suggest that they were going to cut rates again. But that all ended, just a couple of weeks ago, when the Fed chair Powell got on and basically confirmed his previous statements over the last few months that inflation at 7% is still way too high. And so that the Fed is still going to continue to have to raise rates and fight inflation. So the big concern now, not just for the U.S., but globally, is the risk of a recession, meaning declining economic growth. And if you take, declining economic growth, that's likely going to raise unemployment. We're looking at the Fed stated earlier in their statement that they need to bring inflation down and they need higher unemployment. So now we're going to have to combine a recession with higher unemployment and higher inflation. And so that means the risk to the stock market is going to rise dramatically. So to answer your question, long-winded as it is, I think that we're still in a bear market. But we must note that right now, historically, we're in the best seasonal period for the markets. And, the chances of Santa Claus rally are still possible. These typically run the last week of the year and into the first week of the year. So starting next week, we'll have to see if we get a nice little rally here. But do note that stocks do not perform well in a recession. So while we may get a Santa Claus rally here, our models are warning that things are going to start getting pretty volatile, probably starting in the middle of January, and we're expecting to see lower lows before we see higher highs.
Does the U.S. dollar look like it could fall further?
Yeah, it certainly does. Right now, I think actually last time we were on the show, I was talking about how central banks such as China, the ECB, Bank of Japan, they've all been selling the U.S. dollar to try and boost their local currencies. And just last week, the Bank of Japan did a big pivot. They really shocked the market because they actually are allowing that their 10-year yield is going to, the range is going to be able to go up double from 0.25 to 5.0. So that really boosted the yen. And so short term, certainly we could see that have an effect on the U.S. dollar. One thing with the currency markets, they tend to run further than seems logical, and then they slam on the brakes and they head the other way. So we're looking, though, that the U.S. dollar is probably going to form a base here in the next little while, and we're looking right now that the 103 level would be our current target low. And as recession fears grow, we're thinking that investors are going to become much more risk averse, and we expect the U.S. dollar to rise. And, the U.S. dollar is still the main safe haven currency play. So we're looking for near-term resistance to be around 108 to 110. The recent high was at 114, so that remains key resistance. Longer term, we still think that the U.S. dollar is going to hit up to the 120 level. So short term, yes, it could fall further, but long term, we're still bullish on the dollar.
Crude seems to be pulling back with the U.S. dollar. Is this normal?
Well, it does sound counterintuitive given that oil is priced in the U.S. dollar, but it's not unusual for them to move together for periods of time, similar to like gold. Gold and the U.S. dollar often will move at the same time. Now, the U.S. dollar had a big run up driven by the capital inflows from foreign investors wanting to get out of their local currencies, such as the yen and the euro. Plus, of course, we had the Fed raising rates much higher than the ECB or the Bank of Japan. Now, oil, on the other hand, is driven by supply and demand. So we had the China lockdown recently, and that was a big headwind for oil. Plus, we've got recession concerns that hurt oil recently, and we're expecting, you know, that would be further headwinds if we do hit into a global recession. So until we work our way through this potential recession, oil prices are likely to trade in a range, I would say, you know, mid-60s up to maybe mid-90s. But longer term, we're looking at much higher prices into 2023 and beyond. You know, China is starting to open up again, which will certainly help on the demand side. And then we've got, you know, governments imposing all their, you know, windfall taxes, tight regulations, no new drilling permits. These are all major disincentives for producers to invest. So, you know, you get that lack of investment in the sector, that's going to cause some serious supply issues going forward. So, you know, long term, we see oil probably going up to the, say, $150, even $200 level in the next 12 to 18 months. You know, for investors, you know, we're now moved into the stock tax loss selling season. We expect investors would have big losses in those, you know, tech sector especially. They're going to want to offset those losses with gains that they've made from the energy stock. So we're expecting to see some selling off of that, some of those energy stocks. And if we get that, we will be expecting to send out some buy alerts to our subscribers real soon here.
Does it look like gold is in a bull market?
Yeah, you know, gold's looking pretty good here. It's been testing the 1825 resistance level a few times now. Now, unfortunately, it hasn't been able to break through that. Today, last I looked, it was about 1804. So the good news, though, is on the support side, 1630 level is held a number of times, you know, late September, mid-October, early November. So, you know, so we think we're getting a base for me here. Now, the U.S. dollar is obviously a major factor in gold's movement, both, you know, up and down. So one thing that we see interesting, though, Jim, is that the central banks have started to be some big gold buyers here. And they're looking to improve their quality of their international reserves, which could be a good tailwind for gold. So what we're looking at, next resistance would be around that 1825, and then we'd be looking up to 1875. So we're also looking at, you know, the next support would probably be around 1760, and then, of course, that key support at 1630. So gold going forward, if we do get a recession kicking in, we think that people are going to start to really question government. You know, they're going to lose confidence in the government's ability to manage the economy. And as that confidence continues to decline, I think gold's really going to start to rise.
Does it look like silver is in a bull market?
Well, you know, same story as gold, really. You know, gold and silver generally move together, with silver being the much more volatile of the two. So silver rises faster in a bull market, but it also declines faster in a bear market. You know, for example, like gold is up about, 12%, I think, from the November low, where silver's up almost 33-34% from its October low. So, you know, almost three times the gain there. So both gold and silver, like I mentioned earlier, they both seem to have formed a nice base in the last few months. We see, you know, silver's trade right now at $23.90. We see key support in the $18 level. And like I say, longer term, we see significant rally ahead for gold and silver.
What do you see ahead for the Canadian dollar?
Well, the loonie's really struggled in the last month or so, you know, trading between 72 and about 75 cents. You know, there's been a lot of chatter recently where the Bank of Canada suggested that they may pause raising rates after their December, you know, 50-point hike, saying basically that any future increase would be data-dependent. But here we get this week, the inflation rate comes in, and it's, you know, it's higher than forecast, and it's, you know, only down, you know, 0.1 percentage points. It's still, it's, you know, 6.8%, which is really disappointing, I think, for the bank because, you know, they've done all these aggressive moves and the inflation isn't really coming down. Now, higher inflation would mean more rate hikes. And so theoretically that would be bullish for the loonie. But here's the, you know, the big but is, you know, a recession would be really negative for energy and commodities. And so that would put a ceiling on any rise for the loonie. You know, another interesting relationship for the Canadian dollar is that it's very tightly correlated to the S&P 500. You know, they tend to move in tandem. So if we get a boot, you know, if we end up being in a much more bear market, well, then the Canadian dollar is probably going to go down further. In the big picture, of course, it's, you know, it's really the U.S. dollar that drives most currency moves. You know, we may see U.S. dollar weakness early in the year, but if we get a recession, then I think the U.S. dollar is going to be the strongest currency, and that would mean that the Canadian dollar would get weaker. And, you know, I'm looking at probably about 68 cents would be a key support level for that. Now, when we do get the next leg up in commodities, we would see the Canadian dollar do well.
What do you see ahead for the euro and the yen?
Well, lots of interesting things going on with those two. You know, just the other day, I mentioned earlier that the Bank of Japan stunned the market, you know, where they tweaked their bond control program that would allow the long-term yields to rise. Now, you know, they've been keeping their yields down for well more than a decade. So now, based on that, the yen jumped to a four-month high against the U.S. dollar, and it was the biggest one-day rise in over 24 years. So this change in policy, it matters because fund managers have been borrowing yen at those cheap rates, and then they've been exchanging the yen for other assets. So basically, they've been shorting the yen. Now, these investors, they need to cover those short positions, which means they have to buy yen. So that's, again, pushing the yen higher. So if this is a major shift in policy, the Bank of Japan may continue to, you know, allow rates to rise. So that would further boost the yen. Now, on the euro side, you've got the ECB, which also surprised the markets a couple of weeks ago with their, you know, hawkish tones saying that rates are going to rise higher for longer and that their, you know, quantitative tightening program was going to start in the early 2023. So that pushed the euro higher. So one of the things we're really watching for is, does the euro close below 106? Right now it's a little over 106, but if it closes below 106, that's going to validate our model's projection that the euro would be in for a potential deep correction in 2023 at some point. So both of these moves by the ECB and the Bank of Japan has put near-term pressure on the U.S. dollar, and that's obviously boosted both the euro and the yen.
Is the crypto bust comparable to the dot-com bust of 2000?
Well, yeah, it's been 2022 has been a pretty rough year for the crypto market. No question about that. But you know, while many see the happenings this year as the beginning of the end for crypto, we look at it a little bit differently. You know, we're really big believers in the underlying blockchain technology. So when you look at crypto, I really think you need to break it into two sections. So the first being that long-term future blockchain, which I say we're big believers in that. And then the second would be the risk of crypto coins, which certainly has taken a beating this year. So, you know, I think the main result of this FTX debacle is that we're going to see increased regulations in the cryptocurrency sector. And I think that will, you know, that's going to allow that the stronger exchanges are probably going to survive. And then with regulations, I think investors will start to feel more comfortable coming back into that market. But it's going to take time. And, you know, especially with the institutional investors, for them to get their confidence back. So, you know, compared to the dot-com, not sure it's quite the same story, but, you know, it's sort of a similar reaction though.
There's a push on for central bank digital currency in Canada, the U.S., and other countries. Your thoughts on a central bank digital currency?
Well, you know, I think this is something that people really need to pay attention to. This is very Orwellian. You know, this is surveillance at its deepest level. You know, ultimately, these governments, they're looking to eliminate cash. And if they can eliminate cash, then that creates the potential for them to then track and even control consumer spending and any money transfers. You know, we'll be told that it's required to stop terrorism and, you know, the tax avoidance. But, you know, Jim, the vast majority of us, you know, we're not terrorists and we pay our taxes. So That whole line to me is just, a bunch of error here. Now, people need to understand that China is the leader here in digital currencies, and they've created a digital currency as part of that social credit system they have. And under that social credit system, citizens are given, they're given a credit score based on their online and offline behavior. It rewards good behavior, like, spending time with the elderly, and it punishes bad behavior, like protesting the government and spending too much time playing video games. When that trust is broken in one area, then they apply restrictions based, on everything else. So, that means that citizens who have committed maybe some minor infraction, they can be blacklisted, from traveling, from going to restaurants or even movies. So with a digital yuan, every transaction feeds directly into the Communist Party's credit system in real time. So now we have in Canada, the U.S., Europe, and many other countries following China's lead, creating projects of their own to create their own digital currency. And, the real reason is the same as China's. They want to monitor and ultimately control all of your financial activity. It gives government the ability to block funds of any individual or group who protests against the government. I'm pretty sure, Jim, that if the digital loonie was in place a couple of years ago, the Trudeau government would have pretty much shut down anybody who was trying to donate to that trucker movement. And let's not forget that every government is broke. They've compiled massive debts. Well, what if the government were to say, let's withdraw 10% of all bank accounts and to pay off our debts? Well, with digital currency, they could do that. So I really think this is a frightening development, and I really hope it gets fought.
The Bank of Canada raised the bank rate December 7th by 50 basis points. Do you think the Bank of Canada will continue to do the same in the new year?
Well, inflation is still very high. Latest inflation this last week is Canada's at 6.8%. And there's, so far there has been no real sign of any major slowdown there. And the Bank of Canada, like the Fed in the U.S., they said that they want to have a positive real rate. And by that they mean they want that the central bank rate is higher than the inflation rate. Well, today the Canadian bank rate is at 4.25%. Inflation's at 6.8. So that means that they have a negative real bank rate of 2.55%. So if they want to reach this goal, they're going to need a combination of, the inflation coming down and the central bank rate going up in order to get that positive real rate. So they may pause to let the lagging effects of all these increases catch up and, see if they're actually going to knock the inflation down. But I believe that they're still going to have to keep raising rates. They're probably going to do it with smaller increases, but over a longer period of time.
Is 2023 likely to be a bad year for real estate in Canada?
I don't think it's going to be a good year generally. Obviously the real wild card here is the Bank of Canada and its interest rates. And it also really depends on the region. I was looking at the REMAX figures recently, and they forecast a 3.3% decline in prices next year, but that's a national one. But, regionally, it's all over the map. Regionally, they had Barrie, Ontario was minus 15%, Toronto minus 11.5%, Kelowna down 10%, Nanaimo down 10%, and Vancouver down 5%. And on the other side of that, there was, Halifax, they're estimating an 8% increase. Calgary up 7% increase. So, obviously the central bank rates have had a huge influence on the mortgage rates, moving them much higher. Buyers in the very expensive areas like Vancouver and Toronto, they're going to be hit with much higher payments when they renew their mortgages. I'm just looking at an example here, Jim. 2 years ago, a new buyer could get a $500,000 5-year fixed mortgage rate at 1.9%. And the payment ended up being, $2,095. Well, today, that $500,000 5-year fixed rate mortgage is now 5.25%. The payment's now $2,996. So that's a $900 or 43% increase in their mortgage payment. Now, the positive news for real estate is the immigration story. You know, Canada's bringing in about 500,000 new immigrants each year, and I mean, they're going to need a place to live, and we already have a supply problem. So, you know, that's the positive. But overall, I think 2023 is going to be a pretty tough year in most regions.
Martin, where can people follow you and find out more about Trend News?
Well, Jim, they can just go to our website, thetrendletter.com. So again, all one word. Also, I post market notes on the site, and on Friday's post, there'll be a link there offering your listeners some special offers, some great deals, different combinations. You can save between 54 and 65%. Also, your listeners can sign up for our free, yes, free daily headline service. This is where we review what's happening in the markets every morning, and then we send out the headlines that we think investors should be aware of. And, you know, people sign up for this, unlike a lot of other free services where you get all kinds of spam and advertising. There's no spam with this. We hate it. We don't do it. So when they sign up for it, they'll just get the free stuff in the morning, get the headlines. We even throw in a joke for the day, so something there for you. If any of your listeners have any questions about our services or just about the market, they can email us at info@thetrendletter.com.
Martin, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Well, thank you, Jim. Merry Christmas. Happy holidays to you and your listeners.
My guest has been Martin Straith, founder of Trend News online at thetrendletter.com. He was speaking to us from Coquitlam, British Columbia. That's just east of Vancouver. Now we'll go down to San Francisco to talk to Wolf Richter next on This Week in Money.
Introducing Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Wolf Richter, publisher of wolfstreet.com. He's speaking to us from San Francisco. Welcome back to the show, Wolf, and best of the season.
Thanks, Tim, and Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays to everybody.
Wolf, what's the latest at wolfstreet.com, and how can people sign up?
Well, the latest is the Bitcoin miner Core Scientific filing for bankruptcy and what it means. We'll go through some of the details there in terms of who will end up with the company and what it might end up with afterwards. And also home sales, of course, in the United States plunged by 35%. So we've got an article on that, and prices down 10% from the peak that's across the nation. And before then, you know, we have an article about wealth disparity in the United States and how the Fed's quantitative tightening and higher interest rates is actually reducing the wealth disparity between the richest and the bottom 50%. So that's a very interesting piece based on data from the Fed. And it's all at wolfstreet.com. It's free, not behind a paywall. We don't sell anything.
Well, for people willing to pay a premium for electric vehicles over internal combustion engine vehicles?
Yeah, probably that's been the case. You know, they have been willing to pay a premium, but you also have to look at apples and apples. So, for example, Ford just jacked up the price of its Ford Lightning, that's its electric pickup truck, to about $56,000. But, you know, that's a crew cab. So that's a four-door pickup truck, four-wheel drive with nearly 600 horsepower and over 700 foot-pounds of torque. So to get that kind of truck, so apples to apples, and we got to remember, you know, powerful trucks are expensive and they're heavy. So to get an apple-to-apple comparison, you need to look at a Ford Raptor, and that's going to be short on torque, but and the performance is maybe a little lower, but that's roughly there, and they're more expensive. And in order to really get torque of the of these electric motors, you have to go to a diesel, so a four-wheel drive diesel. And that's a lot more expensive, a lot heavier than the F-150 Lightning. So these are the comparisons we have to make, like for like. The same with the Tesla Model 3. So that's the lowest priced Tesla that's out there. But yeah, it's a near luxury performance sedan. So you have to compare that to the BMW 3 Series with which it competes directly. And so. And the one that that matches its performance, and you got to remember that the performance versions of the Teslas outrun the BMWs. You know, they're much faster. So, for example, the four-wheel drive, the all-wheel drive Tesla Model 3, you know, outruns the equivalent 3 Series BMW. And so the prices are apples to apples, are really not higher for EVs. Their advantage is that they have this huge amount of torque and this huge amount of power coming out of these small electric motors, and so they can offer a performance one ICE vehicle really has trouble getting to. And in terms of weight, the same thing. You have to compare apples to apples, and it's really you're not really paying a premium anymore. The average transaction price in the United States for ICE vehicles is $47,000. So new vehicles have gotten very expensive. They have become a luxury item. Even at the low end, you're looking at, you know, the lowest price vehicles, you're looking at $25,000. Yeah. And it's just very expensive to buy a new vehicle today. And the EVs are well equipped. They're luxury vehicles. You know, they have all kinds of electronics and leather and all kinds of fun things in them. And so you cannot compare them to the economical vehicles that you can buy at the low end. They just don't, at this point, EVs are not offered at the low end. You know, they're offering near luxury and luxury, and they're offering performance vehicles. That's what's out there now. You know, we don't have low-end, mass-produced EV on the market yet. I mean, they're coming down a little bit on the performance side, so Kia and others are starting to put EVs out there that have less performance and lower prices. Polestar has one of those, you know, but they're still very performing vehicles. You know, we have an ICE vehicle hybrid, you know, and it just hardly accelerates when you step on it. And an EV will just blow this away, you know, so you really have to compare, the vehicles that you're, you know, that perform similarly. And in that respect, consumers don't pay a premium anymore. You know, that's just how it is. If you want a performance in your luxury, a luxury sedan, or pickup truck, you know, it's not more expensive to buy EV.
Do you expect the demand for EVs to pick up again next summer? This year in September in Vancouver, we were paying $2.67 a liter for gasoline. That's over $10 a gallon, $10.68 a gallon. California was paying some pretty high prices as well. Is that the biggest reason people want to switch, or are they just in tune with the environment? Or the story that goes with it.
I don't really care that much about the environment. I mean, we're Americans, you know. We like big, expensive vehicles, and we've never really cared as a country, you know, as a group of consumers. We've never really cared that much about the environment. I mean, it's great to talk about it, but when it comes down to buying a car, we want big and powerful and nice. You know, that's how we get to a $57,000 average transaction price, because that's what people want. You know, that's what they're buying. And I don't think there are many people that would buy an EV for environmental reasons. It's just that they are superb performers, they're quiet, and they're cheaper to operate, and now they're very competitive to buy. The maintenance is lower if you have a garage. You know, so there's a little different setup required. If you have a garage where you can charge your vehicle up, it's ideal. You know, you plug it in at night, you know, you've drawn down 10-15% of the battery during the day, so you top it off at night. And it is super convenient. You don't have to go to the gas station anymore. I mean, my wife would love to have one, so she drives to work every day, you know, she doesn't have to go to the gas station. And So, you know, they're more convenient if you have a garage. If you don't have a garage, if you need to use public charging stations, you lose that convenience. But, you know, you still go to the gas station. So you go to the public charging station, it's going to take longer. You're going to have to take something to work with you, or you go shopping while you're there. And so there's some little trade-offs, but for people who have a garage, you know, it's cheaper to operate. It's cheaper to maintain. It performs better than most ICE vehicles, you know, and they're just incredibly convenient. And I think that's driving a lot of the demand. And you know, demand is outstripping supply of EVs right now. The long waiting list, you know, people are flipping EVs. They're buying them and then they're trying to sell them for $30,000 above sticker, that kind of stuff. You know, it tells you that there is a level of supply that cannot meet demand at this point. The supply chains aren't there. So right now we don't really know how much demand there is for EVs because we don't have enough supply to measure it. You know, we now have incentives coming, kicking in January 1st. You know, so we're going to have a lot of people that would have bought a Tesla before January 1st. They're going to slow down. Of course, Tesla's come out with a discount of $7,500 until January 1st to equate that rebate that will come out from the federal government on January 1st, you know, so in order to get people off the bottom by Teslas. But, you know, right now, we still have, you know, not enough supply to check where demand actually would be. Once we have oversupply, we can see where the actual demand is, but we don't see that yet.
Is vehicle repossession becoming a big problem in the U.S.?
Well, there's some people talking about it, but I don't see that, you know, during the pandemic, consumers got so much money that defaults on auto loans dropped to historic lows, and that's auto loan defaults are the predecessors of repos, and they have now come up three quarters in a row, those delinquencies on auto loans, but they're still lower than they were any time before the pandemic, so they're just kind of heading back to normal to the record low levels before the pandemic. Yeah, that's really in 2019. You know, when the economy was humming and consumers had jobs and making the money, delinquency rates dropped to record lows, and now we're heading back towards those record lows. And so eventually, you know, depending on the job market, you know, eventually it'll normalize. The same with repos. Now, repos are a function of subprime largely unless there's an unemployment crisis now. And normally subprime auto lending is done by high-risk lenders. It's very profitable because they charge very high interest rates, but you also have high default rates and high repossession. So you figure that in, you know, and this was a super profitable deal while used vehicle prices were going up. So the repossessions actually didn't lose you a lot of money because you could sell it at the auction for a very good price. And so the lender wasn't really out a lot of money. Now all this is normalizing. When you sell a repo at an auction, you're gonna have some loss with that. But since the borrowers pay, you know, a lot of these borrowers pay 15-20% on these auto loans, you know, and so they make 10 payments and then they default on the loan and, you repossess the vehicle. It's an older used vehicle, doesn't lose that much value and you sell it, you know, I mean, it's really a very good business, very profitable business. It's a brutal business. You know, there's a lot of murky areas in there and, occasionally lenders get in trouble, for some of their practices. But, you know, I expect repos to go back to normal levels, and if we get an employment crisis, which we're far from it now, but if we do get another one, yeah, then repos will transcend the subprime space, and they will go up the ladder. And when people lose their jobs, you know, get unemployment compensation, they may have to let one of the two vehicles go in that household. And so we saw that last time. So we saw a surge in auto loan delinquencies and during the financial crisis because of the employment crisis. And so if we get another employment crisis like that, that could be a big surge. But right now, I'm not seeing that. You know, we've got the weirdest and hottest job market out there still. I mean, people get laid off and, 2 days later, they got another job. So I don't see at this point, anything but a normalization of the repos out there.
As economic times get tougher, if someone's in the market to buy a used Corvette, when would they likely get the best deal?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, specialty vehicles are a little bit different, but in general, used vehicle prices have come down some. They've come down more on the wholesale side than they have on retail. On the retail side, dealers are trying to hold the line on them. You know, they're not cutting their prices much. Used vehicle sales volume has come down a lot. I expect prices on the retail side to come down further, I've been saying for well over a year, not to buy a used vehicle unless you have to at these crazy prices. I'm still sticking to that. I think used vehicle prices have more to fall.
Where do you think the Fed is going to go with interest rates in 2023?
Well, it already went a lot further than I thought it would go. So, I thought that with quantitative tightening, the Fed would only have to go to 4% to get this inflation under control. So that was over a year ago. So that was in 2021, early 2021, while the Fed was still ignoring inflation. And so it turns out inflation got a lot worse than I expected, and now the Fed jumped on it, and they're very serious about it. There's a huge problem, and it's not going. I mean, it's people say peaked. It has, according to these people, it has already peaked three times, and it keeps serving up nasty surprises. So it's shifted to services, and the Fed's keenly aware of that. You know, goods prices are coming down, but services prices are surging, and services are two-thirds of the economy, and that's where inflation is now entrenched. So this is a huge problem. And Powell, every time he talks, I mean, he mentions that now, and they're looking at the services inflation in detail. So they're really on top of this now, and finally. And they're talking over 5% already, So with no rate cut inside for 2023, there was a terminal rate over 5%. We're already at the top range is already at 4.5%. So that's where we are right now. They raised 425 basis points so far this year. It won't take a lot more rate hikes to get over 5%. We've heard the first Fed governors talking about 6%. it depends on inflation, and I think inflation will serve up some surprises, and as it always does, it doesn't just go away. There'll be some nasty things happening, and the Fed will have to react to it. So right now, I'm still seeing, the Fed says over 5% in 2023, they're at the low end of over 5%, so 5.1, 5.2% in that range on average, what they're thinking. At the next forecast that comes out, they may raise that. So I expect them to raise that. Actually, they've raised it, the forecast of the top level of inflation, they've raised it at every meeting. Every meeting, the Fed got more hawkish and predicted, higher rate hikes, higher rates, more inflation, for longer. And it's been the same thing. It's been getting, the rates have been going up and up and up. And so I think right now what they're saying for next year is 5.2%. That probably will be exceeded. That probably will go above that.
As interest rates go higher, do you think quantitative tightening will increase?
Yeah, quantitative tightening with Treasury securities right now is running smoothly, and it's $60 billion a month, and eventually, after I don't know how many years, you know, the Fed will run out of treasuries or run low on treasury securities that mature, and it doesn't at this point sell anything. It just lets them mature. You know, there's a lot of treasury securities that are now maturing. But eventually, as the stash comes down, you know, there'll be fewer, and it might change its policy and actually start selling some of them. But right now, with treasury securities, they're rolling off at they're capped at $60 billion a month, and that's what they're doing. The problem is with mortgage-backed securities. You know, our housing sales volume just collapsed in the United States, just as it has in Canada. You know, it's down by 35% year over year. So people aren't buying homes, and when they're not buying homes, they're not selling what they've got, and they're not paying off the old mortgages. And refinance mortgages. So in the United States, it's a big thing. You know, when interest rate drops, you refinance your home into a cheaper mortgage, and we go through this periodically. Well, with interest rates rising, the refis, as we call them, you know, they have just collapsed totally. They're just essentially dead, and cash-out refis are very low. And so the mortgage payoffs are very low, and the Fed gets rid of these mortgage-backed securities when these principal payments from the payoffs are passed through the chain of the mortgage-backed securities to the holders of those mortgage-backed securities, and that has fizzled. Yeah, so those mortgage-backed securities are coming off the balance sheet at a rate of about $20 billion a month instead of $35 billion a month, which is the cap. You know, so we're about $15 billion a month short in the runoff. And the Fed's been talking about actually selling some mortgage-backed securities to speed up the process. And I think we'll hear more about that next year. I think they might do that to where they sell $15 billion a month in mortgage-backed securities to get to that $35 billion. And, you know, that would bring quantitative tightening to the general cap, which is $95 billion a month. You know, that's a pretty good rate. We can already see in the financial market, you know, how that has impacted everything. You know, the asset prices have come way down. You know, quantitative tightening when you have hyperinflated markets is from QE, you know, from 12 years of QE has hyperinflated the market. So now you're doing the opposite of QE. You know, you're taking this liquidity out of the market, and doing that at the current rate has done a job on asset prices. You know, we're seeing cryptos collapse. We've stocks are down over 20% for the S&P 500. The Nasdaq's down 35%. Or more, yeah, today's a big sell-off, so probably down 38% from the peak. You know, so quantitative tightening already has a big impact, and if they go too fast, you know, things can shut down pretty quickly. So I think the pace that they have chosen of about $95 billion a month is a pretty good pace. You know, it's going to take a long time, but it's designed to take a long time. You know, it's not a rate hike policy issue, which come and go. You know, this is planned to go for years, for several years. And, so I think they're probably good where they are, except with mortgage-backed securities where the collapse in mortgage payoffs has really cut the reduction down by a lot. So that will probably bring that up to plan by selling some of them next year.
You live in San Francisco. What's going on with the housing market there?
Oh, gosh. It's a mess. It's a big mess. You know, Twitter, Facebook, all these companies, social media, big tech, they all have big offices in San Francisco. They all have workers in San Francisco. The whole startup scene, the crypto scene, Coinbase, all these companies are headquartered in San Francisco or nearby. And in Silicon Valley, you know, people live here or used to live here. So first we had a working from home or really working from anywhere in San Francisco. So a lot of the employees left the city, went somewhere else, went inland to California where it's cheaper, went across the bay or went to other states. A bunch of them went overseas, you know, working from Thailand or wherever. And so San Francisco over the prior 2 years lost something like 8% of its population. And so now we get all the layoffs. So that's new. You know, that started this year, and we get all the tech layoffs. And obviously Twitter is laying off people all across its footprint in, you know, there's in Seattle and there's in Canada and they have stuff in Europe and they decimated their office in India. But there's still a lot of Twitter employees here in San Francisco. And there's a lot of startups, you know, the crypto scene has been decimated here. Coinbase laid lots of people off. So we're seeing that now in the housing market. And, the price of single family houses in San Francisco has plunged by 27% since April. That was the peak. Sales are way down. Condo prices have dropped 15%, now that's year over year, but, volume has collapsed on condos. So we have this big condo area south of Market. That's essentially dead. All new high-rise towers, you know, and there's nobody in it. And some of them were built for Chinese investors and nobody can sell anything because there's no demand. And so if you really want to sell something, you've got to lower the price. That is a classic San Francisco housing bust. We have boom and bust cycle. So we're really now the first 7 months into a classic San Francisco bust, a fast moving, you know, and we still haven't seen the foreclosures, those kinds of things. It's just people trying to sell. And they may get a job. You know, they got laid off and may get a job, but it's not in San Francisco. You know, they may have to move. And so that's got that issue. So with volume plunging and prices plunging like this, of course, the realtors that I know have been warning about this for a long time. You know, they those that have been around, for years that have been through the dot-com bust in San Francisco, they know how that works. You know, people know the program here and that's what we have. We have with 7 months into a massive housing bust in San Francisco.
What's the latest on the housing bubbles?
Well, overall in the United States, you know, we've got similar to what you have in Canada, you know, we've got a plunge in sales volume and across the United States, it's down 35%. In California, it's down 45% year over year. These are massive, volume drops. Inventory is creeping up. You know, people are not putting the homes on the market because there's no buyers out there at these prices. Prices are way too high. So now across the nation, prices have come down, by about 10% from the peak. In California, prices are now roughly level year over year, down a little bit in the Bay Area. Overall, San Francisco Bay Area prices are way down, year over year and way, way down from the peak. You know, so, new houses and the home builders have been, they've been in a nightmare for a lot longer than that, you know, so they've seen the inventories balloon, to very, very high levels with sales volume dropping off. They're having to give out incentives. They're having to buy down mortgage rates. They're having trouble selling anything. Now they're trying to sell, to rental landlords, whole subdivisions, you know, to get rid of their developments because they can't find individual buyers, so they try to sell them to rental landlords and single family rentals are still doing reasonably well, even though that's already getting hit. So these higher interest rates we have and quantitative tightening and the stock market downturns and the demise of the crypto scene, that has an impact on housing. And it's just slow. You know, the last housing bust took 4 or 5 years to play out, so we're just a few months into it. But it's happening.
Is the crypto bust comparable to the dot-com bust back in the 2000s?
Yeah. During the dot-com bust, the NASDAQ plunged by 78%, and it took about 2.5 years to do that. And it didn't recover for 15 years until money printing finally, after the financial crisis, inflated all asset prices. So this wasn't a brief dip. I mean, this is a huge plunge and it didn't go back to its old high of 5,000 for another 15 years. But that was, pretty widespread. You know, the cryptos are, it's just a narrower thing, and so they're already down 75%, but it's global. So there's global investors involved. There's not that much money concentrated here in the United States. You know, we have a lot of companies in the crypto scene that are now going bankrupt. And I just covered one of them, CryptoMiner. And there's a bunch of others that went bankrupt. I've covered them. You know, so that's happening. So that happened during the dot-com bust, too, a bunch of companies going bankrupt and disappearing. So we're going through that process, and some of these are local companies, and some of these are companies that are in other countries. So far, at one point, the market cap of all cryptos combined was $3 trillion U.S. That's down to less than $800 billion now, so it's already taking off the first $2 trillion plus. There's only $800 billion left, and so if it goes to zero, I don't think it will have that kind of impact that the dot-com bust had. There's a stock market unwind going on that is much bigger and much broader and has a much bigger impact. But the crypto scene alone, I don't think it will have that kind of overall economic impact that the dot-com bust had.
Wolf, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money. And best of the season.
Thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Wolf Richter, publisher of WolfStreet.com. He was speaking to us from San Francisco. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Martin Strafe, and Wolf Richter. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.